I flew on an airplane for the first time in 2 years since the pandemic began to go see my family in Georgia. And there were a lot of things that seemed to have changed in flying on an airplane. Obviously, everyone was wearing a mask for starters, but there were also people with plastic face shields on top of that. And even three people on that flight who were wearing honest-to-God hazmat suits. You know, the head-to-toe plastic suits with the hoods that people wear with the goggles and the respirators? I'm a big believer in protocols and prevention in this pandemic, but that seemed like a little bit much. When I got on the plane, a flight attendant handed me a sanitary wipe inside a plastic packet to use on my seatbelt and tray table, which I think was a great idea, because I don't know about you, but I saw a couple of those documentaries before the pandemic about what lives on the trays on airplanes. This is a good thing. And the only refreshments that were available were just water and pretzels as they went through. There was no choices in that. But there were also things that were the same as always. People tried to cram suitcases much too large for the overhead bins in them, delaying takeoff while flight attendants had to convince them that, yes, they would have to check a bag. The person who always sits in front of me was an adamant seat recliner, slamming their seat back into my lap as soon as they could and leaving it there for the duration of the flight. And as always, there was an almost total disregard for one of the basic rules of our society, standing in line. I don't know what it is about airports, but people who are otherwise decent, law-abiding citizens turn into characters from a movie who are fleeing some kind of zombie horde, pushing others aside and doing whatever it takes to get to the door first. I don't know why airlines even keep up the charade of boarding in groups anymore, because once you get past first class and the elite reward members, it becomes a battle royale for whoever can make their way to the gate first. I was in group 5 out of 5, and I was actually worried that I was going to be left at the airport because everyone else in my group had boarded long before my actual number was called. I almost prefer the way some other countries do it, where it's just a rugby scrum for the door from the very beginning. There's no charade or order of organization, just a Darwinian struggle for overhead compartment space. That dynamic is more or less what's happening with this man at the pool in Jerusalem. The pool of Bethesda, also called Bethesda, was believed to have healing properties from the activity of an angel who would descend from time to time and stir up the water. Bethesda Fountain in the heart of Central Park in New York City is a famous depiction of this story. The catch was only the first person into the water after it had been stirred up would be healed. And so the porticos around the pool served as waiting rooms that were filled with people suffering from all kinds of illnesses, all waiting for that water to start moving. And when it began bubbling and churning, there would be no line. Whoever could walk, crawl, roll, or be tossed in first got healed. That was it. Can you imagine the sight of that event? One person notices the water just starting to move and starts sneaking towards the edge first. But others notice before they get there, and the murmuring and then the shouting rises up, and suddenly everyone is moving, shoving, falling, clawing, doing whatever it takes to get into that water because that water is healing life. And one person triumphs, while the others moan in disappointment and ongoing pain and move back to their waiting positions for the whole thing to start over again. It's not fair. It's not efficient. And it certainly doesn't generate much goodwill. But it is a system of sorts. Everybody knows what to expect. Everybody knows how this works. Everybody knows what the stakes are and what the reward is. And nobody questions it or challenges it until, of course, Jesus shows up. Jesus happens upon one of the many sick people lying in the portico, a man who knows all about waiting. He has spent 38 years of his life waiting to be seen, waiting to be helped, waiting to be healed of this ailment that keeps him unable to walk. Waiting so long that when he is seen by Jesus, Jesus has to ask him, "Do you want to be made well?" The man responds by saying he can't get into the pool in the first place. There's nobody to help him, and so there's nothing that can be done. Except, of course, that there is. You see, Jesus didn't ask him if he wanted to get into the pool. Jesus asked him if he wanted to be made well. Without even waiting for another response, Jesus decides there's not going to be any more waiting. He tells him to stand up, take his mat, and walk. And suddenly, without anything else, the man is able to do exactly that. There's no pool to bathe in, no ritual to follow, no magic to receive. There's no preparation he has to undertake or quest he has to complete, or wisdom he has to obtain. There's not even any faith to prove. The man's faith, or lack thereof, never comes into play. Even his obedience is incidental. He's only able to obey because Jesus enables him to do so. All he has to do is actually respond to Jesus' command to stand up, take his mat, and walk. But that can be harder than it sounds, because it requires not just trust in Jesus, but an ability to see and accept a possibility that not only seems impossible, but probably wouldn't have even occurred to most people to even consider. The Marvel superhero films are best known for their sprawling epic plots and stunning special effects, but within that, they often contain powerful themes and surprisingly insightful scenes. One of my favorites is in the first Captain America movie. If you haven't seen it, all you really need to know is that the superhero Captain America starts off life as a young man named Steve Rogers, who is deeply patriotic, has a strong moral strength, and profound determination, but he's also characterized by being particularly short and scrawny and physically weak. At the onset of World War II, he's desperate to enlist and fight against the Nazis, but he's rejected because of his health and physical limitations. Despondent, he's overheard lamenting his unfulfilled desire to fight for his country by a government scientist who recruits him for a secret project looking for suitable candidates to receive an experimental serum designed to turn one of them into the world's first super soldier, somebody with superhuman strength and speed and reflexes. And so, as you might expect, the candidates for this are put through a grueling training and evaluation program in which Rogers consistently lags behind the other candidates in every physical activity. One day, the candidates are out on a long formation training run when their drill instructor directs them to a flagpole on the side of the road. He tells them that they've only reached the halfway point of their very long run, but that the first man to bring him the flag from the top of the flagpole will get a ride in a Jeep all the way back to the barracks. So, hearing that, all the men except Rogers rush the flagpole, struggling with each other to mount the flagpole and shimmy up it, but without success because it's made out of something that's unusually slick. Amused by this display, the drill instructor finally says that nobody has gotten that flag in 17 years of the challenge, and it was time to get back on the run. They return to the road, but then Rogers ignores the drill instructor and approaches the flagpole, but he doesn't attempt to climb it. Instead, he bends down and releases a catch, and then pulls the iron bolt out of the joint, When he does so, the flagpole collapses on its side with the flag still attached, now only 20 inches above the ground instead of 20 feet. He then simply walks over, unhooks the flag from the top of the pole, and folds it up. He wordlessly hands it to the instructor and then walks over to the Jeep, climbs in the back, and smiles as he's driven away, leaving both the drill instructor and the other candidate standing there staring dumbfounded after him. The first person in 17 years to realize that you don't have to climb a flagpole to get to the top of it. After 38 years and an exchange with Jesus, this man realizes he doesn't have to be pit in the pool in order to be healed. When Jesus gives him this command to stand up, take his mat, and walk, he does so. But with that pivotal question still hanging in the air, do you want to be made well? When Jesus asked it, his response was basically, it can't be done. He never considered until he simply listened to Jesus and obeyed him that there might be another way than simply following the way people had always been healed here. And he knew that he couldn't climb that flagpole and claim the prize by himself. So Jesus essentially drops the flagpole on its side so the top comes down and almost hits him on the head. All he has to do is to follow that command. Stand up, take your mat, and walk. And when he does, his entire world, his entire identity changes. It goes from the all too familiar paralysis, literally and figuratively, to wide open possibilities, if as yet unknown ones, stretching out on the way ahead of him. I believe that's where we are right now as a congregation. I think most of us had hoped that the end of the pandemic would have a familiar, predictable conclusion to it. Vaccination would become widely available, people would embrace it as the way of ending the threat of the virus, infections would fade away, if not be outright eradicated, not unlike the polio epidemic of the 1950s. For all kinds of reasons that you all know very well, that hasn't been the case. And the prolonged length and impact of the pandemic has caused all kinds of problems in every corner of our society, from healthcare to children's education to the economy to church life. Right now, churches all over the country, regardless of size or style or theology or location, are all struggling to deal with what this means when the things that were used to happening, being open on Sunday mornings, people coming in and worshiping, and going back out again, are changing, with fewer people coming and people coming less often. And the temptation then, when considering how we might recover or be made well, is to echo the words of the man lying beside the pool, despairing that there's no one coming to help us. But as with him, that's the understandable but wrong answer to the right question. Because the good news is that we don't have to find a way to get ourselves into the pool or up the flagpole. All we have to do is actually try and follow Jesus' command. Stand up, take your mat, and walk. And the promise is that when we do so, we find all kinds of wide open and unimagined possibilities in the road before us. And the truth is that many of those possibilities are far from unknown for us, because this congregation has done a remarkable job of not falling victim to paralysis during the pandemic. We shifted our worship online and gathered there when we couldn't safely do so here. We reached out with compassion and care to those in our congregation and in our community who were hungry, isolated, sick, or grieving. We partnered with others to provide masks for first responders and medical caregivers when they were in short supply. We used our building to help do so when we ourselves couldn't be in our building together. And we found all kinds of ways to continue worshiping God and deepening our faith and strengthening our community with one another and with God and with our neighbors. Standing up and walking when it would have been easy to say, there's no one to help us do the things the way we've always done them. The way it would have been easy to assume that they had to be done. And so as Advent and Christmas and a new year stretch before us, we can walk forward into them with confidence and strength. Because we already know that when we follow Jesus' command to stand up and walk, he goes with us and before us on the way. Not back to what we've always known, but forward into great new possibilities to love God and each other and our neighbors. So in a few moments, we'll take the first steps on that way when we stand up and walk forward for our stewardship dedication. And when you do that, know that you're doing that dedicating not just a pledge to support the mission and ministry of this congregation. No, you're dedicating yourself to walking on the way into the future that God is calling us to. A future in which we are certain of the most important things. That the way holds extraordinary promise and opportunity, even when we might not be able to see it yet. A way that will ensure that there's healing for us to both receive and to offer and share. And that Christ walks with us every step of the way. Thanks be to God. In the name of the Father, and Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.